What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Shawnee Baker is a co-victim, mother of five, an author, nonprofit organization founder, and nurse from Ontario, Canada. In this episode, Shawnee shares about her daughter, Bailey, a bright, motivated college sophomore with hopes of becoming a neurologist. However, as Bailey's second year of college began, her life would be tragically cut short under suspicious, allegedly criminal circumstances. Now, Shawnee is working to bring awareness, education, and safety resources to young adults all over the country in honor of Bailey's legacy. The Broken Cycle Media team is incredibly grateful for Shawnee's willingness to share Bailey with our audience, as well as for her grace, wisdom, and advocacy. This episode is in loving memory of Bailey Grogan.
My name is Shawnee Baker. I'm Bailey's mom. I'm also the mom to four other children, Mackenzie, Tristan, Serafina, and Savannah. My family would describe me as very loving, nurturing, compassionate, and determined. I was born in Oakville, Ontario, just north of Toronto is where I was raised. I had my three children very early in life. I was 19 when I had Mackenzie. I had two other babies before I was 23, and Bailey was my last. Bailey was born in Texas. I was working in San Antonio at the time. And my husband then, we were having some challenges in our marriage. When Bailey was 6 days old, he left. I returned back to the Toronto area with my three children, got sole custody of them, and raised them in Toronto when I met my current husband. We were dating online. One thing led to another, and about 10 years ago, I came to the U.S. and started working at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. I was in the NICU as a NICU nurse. Bailey's early years were challenging for me as a mother, but she has always shown to be an exceptional child. Bailey and I were closer than any mom and daughter could be. Truly an exceptional relationship. If anyone asked Bailey who her best friend was, she always answered my mom, probably from being a single mom for so long. She was my only daughter. The boys were older, and we just had a connection like no other. She was very resilient right from the get-go. Bailey did so many incredible things in her life in her short time here. As a young person, she was a shining light. She would miss recess to help someone else do their homework and stay inside and work with kids who were struggling. Bailey was just that kind of person. She was in preschool when she first told me she wanted to be a doctor. Being a doctor was always there. In fact, it never wavered for her. She never once changed her mind. Bailey was also just a very focused kid. She was highly academic. She was valedictorian of her class. She was a lifeguard, an equestrian rider. She was a dancer. Bailey excelled at so many things. She was accepted into several colleges, and the University of Miami was on her dream board. She wanted to go into neurology. She was accepted on almost a full scholarship to the University of Miami. There really wasn't any discussion. We knew where she was going. When Bailey went to school, it was just heartbreaking. I felt like I had lost my best friend, but I was so happy for her because the first year as a freshman at the University of Miami was so great. She was on the equestrian team. She joined Zeta Chi Alpha sorority. She had found her niche. She had found her group of people, and she was doing so well academically. I was so proud of her. The summer that she came home, she took 8 extra credits at UNH in order to be ahead of the curve. She wanted to keep her GPA up, which she had to do for the neuroscience program, but she really wanted to make sure that her course load was manageable. So she took sophomore credits through the summer in physics, and then she worked 2 jobs. She was a lifeguard through the day when she wasn't studying and waitressing at night. So Bailey really didn't go out very much. She was just such a focused kid and so mature for her age, again, probably because of our circumstances of being in a family with a single working mom and just having to step up to the plate and be really mature and responsible at a young age. It was a fantastic summer. We spent so much time together. We would go to the beach at lunch whenever she could. We just lived 2 miles from the beach, and that was her safe place. She loved going there. Before she left for Miami, we did the whole family tour. We went out to Calgary, where her 2 brothers now reside. We had a visit with them, and then we went to Toronto and visited with my mom and dad and my sister, her friends from grade school. She basically got to say goodbye to everybody. On August 11th, Bailey and I flew down to the University of Miami to set up her dorm room and get her settled. I spent the week there with her. We spent some time going to the beach and going out for dinner and doing fun things. And then I left on a Thursday night and flew back to New Hampshire, which was the most difficult goodbye. I thought freshman year was a hard goodbye, but for some reason, that Thursday night was incredibly painful. She felt it. I felt it. I was crying when I left. She said, "Mom, please don't cry. You're going to make me cry." I said, "I love you. Please be safe." I went to the elevators and then I just sobbed all the way to the airport. She called me just before I got on the plane and she said, "Mom, I just have this strange feeling. I don't know what's wrong, but I don't want you to go on that sailboat trip tomorrow." And I said, "Why? What's wrong?" And she said, "I can't really tell you, but I just know that you need to stay home. You shouldn't be on that sailboat." And I said, "Oh, Bailey, I think it's just nerves. Everything's going to be fine. I'll call you every day. I'll let you know how things are going. And we'll play it by ear." We did this annual sailboat trip. We went off the coast of Maine the following morning. I talked to Bailey on the Saturday through the day. It was a normal conversation. Bailey told me that her sorority sisters were going out that night. It was the first weekend back at school. And one of the boys had a 21st birthday party. Bailey was on campus, but these boys were renting a house with a pool. They were going to have a pool party at his place and then go out that night with the sorority girls. We talked about, "Be safe. Please let me know you're safely home. Text me. Have a great time." I trusted Bailey. She was an incredibly responsible girl. Bailey was the designated driver. She was the mother hen. She was the one who would take away her girlfriend's drink if they walked away and left it unattended. She looked after everyone. Never in a million years did I think anything could happen to Bailey. So what we understand is that Bailey went out to the party. There were, I think, 8 kids there. There was drinking through the afternoon. And I think around 3 o'clock, they went back to the dorm room, her and her roommate. They showered, changed, got ready, ate some dinner, and then planned to go back out with the sorority girls. There was a big group of sorority girls that were going over to an apartment complex, which is where a lot of the sophomore girls had housing off campus. My understanding is that they were at these apartment complexes, and a group of girls said, "Let's go into downtown Miami and go to some of the clubs." Bailey's roommate did not go and suggested to Bailey that it wasn't a good idea and that she was going to stay back at the apartments with some of the friends. A group of about 4 or 5 girls were going and Bailey decided to go with them. Bailey was only drinking water at that point. We know that she started drinking water around 7 p.m. and didn't drink again throughout the night. But she did go down to the clubs. She was in one of the bars underage, as were all of them. At that point, Bailey decided later in the evening, the boy from the party was texting her because he was also at another club downtown and said, "Hey, let's get out of here. I've kind of had enough. Do you want to head back?" And she said, "Yeah, I'm all set. Let's go back to campus." She left the bar and separated from her friends. Her friends said, we shouldn't separate. We need to stick together. She said, yeah, I know, but I'm going to meet him on the sidewalk and we're going to go together in an Uber back. So I won't be alone. She leaves the bar and he stood her up. He didn't come. She's texting him and he says, I changed my mind. I'm not going. And she's like, well, great, because I'm outside now. She texts her friends and they said, we'll get back in. She said, I can't. They won't let me back in the club. So she said, don't worry about it. I'm going to get an Uber back to campus. She calls for her Uber, which we have the times on. And while she's waiting for her rideshare to show up, she's approached by two young men who tell her that they are med students at the University of Miami, and they're headed back to campus too. They get chatting about what dorm she's in. They know the dorm, they know the campus, they know everything. So it feels pretty familiar to her. They tell her that their rideshare will be there any minute. Sure enough, their rideshare comes, and they say to her, hop in with us, we'll share the fare so that it doesn't cost you anything and you can just get a ride back. She cancels her Uber ride at that time and gets in with these two men who are not med students. They're in their 30s. Bailey is sitting in the middle of the back seat between the two men. Very shortly realizes they're not headed back to campus. They're on a different path. And she lets her roommate know, I'm with some sketchy guys. And her roommate is asking her where she is. And she said, we're lost in a rideshare. I'm with these random bros. They won't tell me their real names. And that's where it starts to get scary. They stop at what looks to be a convenience store, a place to get a water. The story is that Bailey wanted to have a water. The Uber driver says they offered a water. We're not sure how this water comes about, but they stop to go get a water. And there's a video camera on the sidewalk that shows the door of the rideshare open. And you can see Bailey in the car sitting in the middle with the other young man. The one man goes in to get the waters, but instead of going into the shop, he takes a different door and goes above the shop to an apartment. He comes back down from his apartment 5 minutes later with a solo cup and gives Bailey the solo cup with a straw. She kind of questions that. She texts her friends and she says, they're trying to get me to drink the water. They want me to drink the water too much. But she does drink some of the water. And at some point, she spills it in the rideshare. The Uber driver gets upset, pulls over to kick them all out, and says that they're responsible for the cleaning charge for the spilled water. The Uber driver tells him there will be a $200 charge on his credit card, and that doesn't matter to him. He runs into the nearest club and gets another water in an open cup. You see him reach in his pocket, but the umbrella by the video camera on the sidewalk hides what he's doing, and he passes Bailey another water. But at that point, she refuses and leaves. She's gone. She's walking into the crowd. She basically has gotten away. They're not chasing her, so it's not like she's escaped them, but the subtle attempt to give her this roofie, we believe, is over, and she's caught on to them. So now she's texting her friends, calling her friends, saying, something's wrong with me. Come get me. I need help. They can't come get her. They ask her what's wrong, and she says, I can't use my phone. And they said, you need to call an Uber. Take a rideshare back here. And she said, guys, you don't understand. I don't know how to call an Uber. I don't know how to use my app. And they said, you've used it all day. What do you mean you don't know how? And she said, I can't figure it out. And I can't figure out how to use GPS. And they said, okay, well, we're going to send you a PIN for our location. See if you can open it. They send the PIN by text. She clicks on it. She says, oh, thank God, I can open that. They said, okay, well, walk home to the apartments where we are, and we'll follow you on Friend Finder. It's 3 a.m. now, and it's pouring rain in downtown Miami, and she's 3 miles away from the girls. She walks into 6 lanes of traffic. The girls are watching her on Friend Finder, and the dot stops moving on their phone. They start texting and calling and saying, Bailey, you haven't moved in 10 minutes. And then they heard sirens. They ran downstairs and out on the street. and Bailey had been hit. I didn't have service all night. Sunday morning at 8 a.m, I was sitting on the back of the sailboat having a coffee, watching the seals of all things, thinking life was wonderful. I had a signal and I sent her a text to say, how was your night? And it bounced back. And I thought, that's strange because I have bars. Why isn't it going through? And literally just like that, the phone rang and it was the Miami Police Department. They asked if I was Bailey's mom and I said, yes. They said, there's been a terrible accident. Bailey's alive, but you need to come to Miami immediately. And I said, what do you mean? What kind of accident? We can't tell you anything over the phone. You need to come to Miami right now. I'm like, did she break her leg? We can't tell you. Where is she? She's in the hospital. Well, how is she? I'm sorry, we can't tell you anything. So I get off the phone. I go to get my husband. He calls the officer. Same story. He's not told anything. Come to Miami now. He says, here's the number for the hospital. They might be able to give you more information. He calls the hospital. The surgeon is with her in surgery. They won't tell us what kind of surgery. Turns out it was neurosurgery. She had been in surgery all night. Finally, the surgeon calls him back. Again, there's no information because we don't have a healthcare proxy or a HIPAA waiver or a power of attorney. And Bailey's over the age of 18, so they can't tell us anything. And he asks us if we have the paperwork. And we said no. So he said, well, then you need to get on a plane and come to Miami. My husband says, we're 3 hours offshore on a sailboat. This is going to take some time. And he said, you may be coming to Miami to say goodbye to your daughter. I suggest you get here immediately. We turned around the boat, got on a plane and flew there. We didn't get there until 11 o'clock Sunday night. We walked into the ICU and we saw her and we knew how bad it was. They told us what her injuries were. They told us about the surgery, what had happened, what she had been through. We understood that she'd been hit by a car. We got a list of 25 injuries, everything from a fractured spine, fractured neck, possible paralysis, multiple head injuries, multiple bleeds in her brain. She was cut from sternum right through to her groin and left open because of the swelling and the internal bleeding. I worked trauma ICU for a while. I'd never, ever seen a patient who looked as bad as my daughter. She had a Glasgow Coma Scale of 3, which is the lowest neurological score you can have before death. We sat at her bedside all night. The next day, the police came in, asked to speak to us, and the questions are starting to come, like, why was she walking alone at 3 a.m. in downtown Miami? What happened? The police said, we believe your daughter was roofied. This is the town it happens in. We've seen it many times. And the video surveillance of her crossing the street when she's hit by a car gives us reason to believe that there was foul play. She doesn't walk like a drunk person. She walks like someone who's drugged. We didn't really understand how they would know that. So he showed my husband and the boys the video. I didn't want to see it. I couldn't stomach it. And in the video, she doesn't stumble, but she's completely unaware of her surroundings. And evidently with these date rape drugs, Rufinol and GABA, they impair your senses. So that proprioception and sensory input is gone. Cars would come up to her, slam on the brakes right at her hip, lay on the horn, flash their lights. They swerved around her. She didn't even lift her head up and look at the car. She just looked straight and kept walking. Two witnesses at the scene where she was hit told police they had never seen anyone like it. He said she was like a zombie. And the other man said it was like she was having an out-of-body experience. She didn't acknowledge anything around her. We went back into the ICU. The police said, we need toxicology. We need to know what's in her system. So we asked the physician in the ICU if they had done blood and alcohol levels on our daughter. And they said, unfortunately, the protocol is, on a trauma patient, do not draw blood samples for alcohol or drugs because the insurance companies will deny the claim. We asked for it to be drawn. We didn't have rights. Bailey didn't have a HIPAA waiver in place. And although we were next of kin, maybe Bailey didn't want her parents to know that she had alcohol or drugs in her system. And the ethics committee would have to make that decision. So then we went back to the police and said, they didn't order it. You need to order it. And the police ordered it. By the time we got the toxicology screen, it was too late. It was 36 hours later, and the drugs were long gone. At that point, we realized that without evidence of those drugs, there would never be a conviction. So although we could bring charges up against these gentlemen based on the video surveillance and the circumstantial evidence we had, at the end of the day, we didn't have proof that the drugs were in her system. The second part of that was legal papers that we didn't have. Without having either power of attorney, healthcare proxy, or HIPAA waiver, we did not have access to Bailey's medical records. We had friends in New York and in Boston who were neurosurgeons who wanted to review her brain scans, her CT and MRI on admission. They felt that they could at least give us some idea of prognosis. Not that we didn't trust what was happening in Miami, but we wanted a second opinion. We asked for the scans, we asked for medical records, and we were denied. And that's because although we were next of kin, Bailey was over the age of 18, and we didn't have those legal paperwork to get all of her files. Later, we learned how significant it was, but at that moment, we didn't really fight it because we thought everything was being done that needed to be done. I really thought being her mom and next of kin was enough. I was just stunned at what was unfolding in front of us. We did have a say for some things, for minor things, and we get this pushback all the time. Not in our hospital, not in our state. That must be state to state. But the reality is there is a gray zone. And the gray zone in medicine is how incapacitated is that person over the age of 18 if you don't have the forms? And what are the decisions that need to be made? Had Bailey been in a life and death situation on day one where they felt that she was completely brain dead and that we had the decision to either pull the plug and let her go and end life support or not, we would have had that choice as next of kin. That's cut and dry. But when you don't have the right as next of kin is when it is in this gray zone where, wait a minute, she might have some brain activity. We just don't know how much. She might live through this. We just don't know. What is her trajectory? Could she be the age of a three-year-old mentally? Or is she going to be like an infant? Or maybe she won't have any capacity at all and she'll be completely vegetative. We just don't know right now. And if there's any brain capacity at all, then you don't have any authority. You need to go to court for that. And in order to go to court for that, there was a two-month delay to get guardianship of our own daughter. When you don't have the legal paperwork in place and a terrible tragedy like this happens, the courts must award you guardianship again because you only have guardianship till they're 18. We didn't know that. And so the ethics committee of the hospital takes over guardianship. They didn't really verbally say that we're the guardians now. It was just sort of assumed. And any major decisions that happened, the ethics committee was there in the meeting and they would speak on Bailey's behalf. That was really hard to take. It was like salt to the wound. It just hurt. Here I am losing my daughter and also losing my right as a mother. So not only were we faced with the grief and the overwhelming shock and heartache of Bailey's condition, but that was compounded with this incredible loss of control as her mother. I was her everything and she was mine, and I was the person who needed to speak for her. I was her voice. And all of a sudden it was taken from me and I didn't even know that that could happen. We stayed with Bailey for the next 4 weeks in Miami where she was in the neuro ICU. They continued to do testing and wait day after day to see what kind of progress there would be. Her neurological status did not change for over a week. She remained with a GCS of 3, which is as close to death as possible. There's no reaction to pain, no movement, no sound, nothing. Her pupils were both non-reactive. They went back and did more CT scans and MRIs. There was no change. They tried to close her abdomen on several occasions, but she was just itty-bitty. And to have all this internal swelling, there wasn't enough skin to close her. She remained open and packed for probably 10 days before they were actually able to close her abdomen up. So there was a lot going on. We had assessments by probably 4 different neurologists who would come and go and do different testing on her to give us an idea of where she would be. About 2 weeks after being there, they were able to get her off the ventilator. Now, that's a really big step. For anyone who's in medicine, they understand that once you come off the ventilator, you're off life support. She had a tracheotomy. and she was breathing through that tracheotomy. And that meant that there was enough of the brainstem working to allow her to breathe, probably because she was a healthy 19-year-old before the trauma. That changes the ability to allow someone to die. Once they're breathing on their own, you're in a whole different category. There were a lot of serendipitous things that happened in Bailey's life. She left breadcrumbs, we sort of discovered after this tragedy had occurred, and all of a sudden, there were signs that I didn't expect. Things were coming up for me that were really beyond coincidence. When the tragedy occurred, there was a book on Bailey's nightstand. She was a neuroscience major, but the book was called Into the Gray Zone. It was written by Dr. Adrian Owen, and it was a study on patients who had been in a coma. Basically, the study discovered that 25% of patients who were diagnosed as being in a coma are actually fully awake and aware. They're just unable to express that. And so for years and years, these poor people lived in a vegetative state and no one knew that they were in there. And the bookmark she was on, the page she was reading, was about a 19-year-old girl who was hit by a car and in a coma. And Bailey was 19, hit by a car and in a coma for 6 weeks. The book was called Into the Gray Zone, and it was a study on patients who had been in a coma. The study discovered that 25% of patients who were diagnosed as being in a coma are actually fully awake and aware. A functional MRI was the study that they did to discover whether the person was actually in that comatose state or whether they were unaware and unconscious and gone, if you will. That trial study was being done in the United States at Mass General Hospital by Dr. Brian Edlow. 2 weeks later, we got her transferred to Boston. She's admitted into Mass General under Dr. Brian Edlow, who was the doctor in her book. She almost didn't make it. Bailey had resuscitation probably 3 times because she was trying to go and we weren't letting her. Dr. Edlow said to us, there's this trial study. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's called a functional MRI, and we're looking for consciousness inside of a patient who's in a coma. And I said, oh my God, I do know about it. Bailey was reading the book. It's on her nightstand. I brought the book in and I showed her doctor the book. He couldn't believe it. And he said, well, your daughter's going to be the first patient in this clinical trial in the U.S. So Bailey went through the clinical trial. They did the functional MRI on her and they asked her all the questions. And under MRI, if they ask the question, the area of the brain lights up if the person is trying to respond but can't. And they looked for all those lights to go off in her brain and nothing did. The only area of her brain that had any electrical activity at all was right behind her ears. She could hear when they spoke. It lit up right at her ears, but the signal didn't go anywhere. The rest of her brain was completely shut off. The following day, Dr. Edlow called for a meeting for us to meet the team. We went to this meeting at a big round table. There's 4 physicians, social work, ethics committee, clergy, nurses. I felt like 20 people were at the table. They said to us, we have some unfortunate news for you. The initial CT and MRI of your daughter shows a significant injury in her brain that was not identified in Miami. And we're like, how much worse could it be? And they said, well, beyond the 4 significant brain bleeds that they've identified, there is a brain bleed in her brain stem. It's about 2 to 3 inches long. It's called a Durette hemorrhage. The chances of survival are about 1%. Combined with the other injuries your daughter has, it's almost incompatible with life. In fact, we don't have any case study documented anywhere of anyone surviving the catastrophic injuries that your daughter has. She will probably never come out of a coma. She will be in a permanent vegetative state, significant enough that she'll never open her eyes. She will never make a sound. She will never hear you or know where she is. And she will need 24-hour care, probably in an institution. This is not acceptable to me. This is not a life that Bailey would want to survive. It's one thing to think that she's going to be severely disabled. Another thing to say, maybe she won't even have the mentality of a 3-year-old. But to tell me that she'll never even open her eyes and be bedridden for the rest of her life, that was Bailey speaking to me, saying, "There, Mom, you read the book. You understand. This is what I want." And we were stuck because the law said, "She's breathing on her own. There's nothing you can do." Completely unacceptable. I cannot tolerate this. As a mother, I now feel like I've trapped my daughter. This is like a living hell. I knew she would not want this life. And the panic that came over me in that meeting, I cannot tell you, was worse than having her die. I wanted her to die so badly. I prayed and prayed and prayed for God to take her. We begged and we pleaded, and they said, "Well, if you had a healthcare proxy, if you were power of attorney, you would have some decision making at this time. But you don't have that paperwork. You are not able to make those choices for her." We got a legal team to fight this. We wanted Bailey to go. We knew she wanted to die. After a couple of weeks of talking to the ethics committee, talking to the lawyers of the hospital, we had to contact her biological father, who had left her at 6 days old and no longer had custody and had no contact with her for the last 20 years. It was insane. We had to get at least 10 family members and friends who agreed that Bailey would not want this quality of life. And if everybody verbally agreed on the phone with the ethics committee and a physician and a lawyer, they would take that into consideration on their final decision and they would let Bailey die. So we did all of that. We complied with all of their requests. And on a Sunday night at 9 o'clock at night, my husband got a phone call from the lawyers representing the CEO. And he said, "The CEO of the hospital has decided that we need to leave Bailey. She's going to live. We will not honor your request." And we said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, everybody is unanimous that she would not want to live this way. But unfortunately, we have the risk of liability to the hospital of $25,000. That's the maximum someone can sue for." And my husband said, "I'll cut you a check for $25,000 right now. Please let her go." And they said, "I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. Someone could come out of the woodwork years later and say that we let her die and we shouldn't have." So my husband said, "Well, tomorrow morning, please make sure your PR department is ready, because I will have this in every news station and I will let everyone know how much money the hospital makes off of our daughter in the ICU." Bailey's medical bills were in the millions at this point. Half an hour later, the hospital called back and they said, "The CEO has changed his mind. We're going to transfer her to palliative care and let her die." We had a brief moment of relief and we were, I guess, grateful, for lack of a better word. I don't know how to say it. And within seconds, I was sobbing because I had just let my daughter die. That's a really hard pill to swallow, but I knew I was doing the right thing. I knew I had to let her go and that I was honoring her. I was doing what was best for her, not what was best for me. And I knew, going back to the breadcrumbs, Bailey told me this is what she wanted. I read that book cover to cover. And as I got to the end of the book, it became very evident that people who were in vegetative states, in these bodies that were broken beyond repair, that it was really not a nice existence, and that many of them wished they could die, which I believe was her message to me. That was her way of letting me know, "It's okay, Mom, let me go." These messages that she showed me became very evident after she passed, that her soul knew her contract, knew her life's mission, and there was some divinity to this. As much as it was painful, I needed to face the fact that perhaps there's more to this than what we know as humans, and perhaps there was more to Bailey's story than what I understood. She got transferred to palliative care. We went down the next day to see her. It's just an unbelievable amount of emotion. Not to mention I was pregnant at the time. I got to the doors of the palliative care unit. I read the sign. I've been a nurse for 20 years. I know what it means. This is where you go to die. It's like opening the door to a funeral home. I literally could not physically open the door. I collapsed outside of the building and I sobbed hysterically. I couldn't do it. I said to my husband, "I can't go in there. I can't do this." It was one of the worst moments for me. It was like walking into a fire. I went in, I saw her. They had discontinued everything. Bailey was breathing on her own. In some states, there is an option to withdraw care. In Florida, the option would not have been there to withdraw care. In New Hampshire, the option wouldn't have been there to withdraw care. The option was there for Canada. She's a Canadian citizen. She had dual citizenship. We could have flown her to Canada and done this. And that was our ultimate plan. But Massachusetts law says that you can withdraw care if the quality of life is significantly compromised, which it was. Withdrawing care means she's breathing on her own, but we will not provide any assistance, meaning all medication stops, all intravenous fluid stops, we will not feed her or provide antibiotics. So if she dies of an infection, we won't intervene. If her heart stops beating, we won't help her, we won't resuscitate. Essentially, she will starve to death in about 10 days. So I had to make that horrific choice to starve my daughter. In this whole process, Bailey starts to look horrific because the central nervous system had shut down. So she was like twisting and curling up. Her neck became twisted. Her hands were completely contracted. Her legs came up around her body in the fetal position. She had lost so much weight. She was like 80 pounds. I climbed in bed with her and I laid with her and I hugged her and I held her and told her how much I loved her. And I begged her to go with the angels to do it on her own. There was nothing left for her here. She had to go. We went home the following day. The stress of it had caused so many contractions for me that I was very high risk. My OB was like, you can't keep doing this. The emotional strain on the baby, you're not eating, you're going to have a preterm baby at the same time that you're going to have this situation happening. So between my OB and my husband, they said, look, you got to stay home today. I did. And that night we got a call that Bailey stopped breathing and that she passed. She took 3 days to die. I was in the shower getting ready. My husband got the call. He walked into the shower with all of his clothes on, so I knew. We just sat on the floor of the shower with the water running, crying. At the time that this happened, when the criminal investigation was going on, we had a lot of media reaching out to us. I just didn't have the strength. I really, really didn't. I was about to deliver a baby in 3 months. I was grieving the loss of my daughter. I could not talk about it at that time. I could not get out of bed. I couldn't shower. I couldn't eat. I just cried day and night. I went into complicated grief. I delivered a baby and went into postpartum psychosis and anxiety and depression. I had it all. For 2 years, I was down. I was done. In hindsight, I wish I had been able to utilize the media more because I think we could have had justice based on our story if I'd have had the strength to get it out there right away. Because it was fresh. The men were still out there committing the crimes. They still are committing the crimes. The Sex Trafficking Coalition reached out to us. They believe that Bailey was a target for sex trafficking. The man who ordered the Uber had ordered it to do a 5-mile loop around the outside of the city. They will book a 5 to 10 mile loop, drug the girl in the rideshare, and then take her to the airport. After this happened to Bailey, we learned that 2 other girls at the University of Miami were taken on the loop, given the drugged water, and woke up at the hotel across from the airport. Sadly, the reputation of the colleges, and not just the University of Miami, all of the colleges, supersedes, in my opinion, a lot of the safety that's required for this. There was a documentary done years ago called The Hunting Grounds, and it's about going to colleges and preying on these young girls and how it's covered up. I'd like to think that that is not the case, but I can't help but feel there is some part of that, which is why we're doing the Bailey's Wish Foundation. Bailey's Wish Foundation is to honor her wish to die and to make sure that these legal forms are in every school with every college admission paperwork there is. Just give everybody the forms at 18 and just have it a part of our normal lives so every parent has those forms in place. Secondly, Bailey's wish would have been for safety for students and preventing this tragedy, which is why we've launched this huge campaign on the hidden dangers of college. We want to do a nationwide campaign to talk to students and parents about the things that no one talks about roofies, about sex trafficking, about sextortion, about online scams, domestic violence, and online dating, and the things that are happening behind the scenes. It's not just drugs and alcohol in college. People need to understand what all the protocols, policies, and laws are. And what does it mean when those laws don't work for you? Why don't kids call 911? Why don't students reach out for help? When Bailey said, come get me, there was no way to go get her. They couldn't call anyone for help. And they never thought to call 911 because everybody was underage drinking. That's a part of my nonprofit as well, is taking away that fear. It became a barrier for them getting help for Bailey. And it shouldn't be a barrier. There needs to be more amnesty around the drinking underage off campus, and know that these kids are not going to get in trouble if they call for help. We wanted to share this with other students at the college. We wanted to share it with the sorority girls and let them know what the police suspected had happened. And we were told that it would just scare them, and we didn't need to do that. They didn't want to frighten anybody. They didn't want anyone overreacting. They asked us to keep it quiet. There's duty of care, and then there's duty to warn, and it falls under the duty to warn, and there was no duty to warn. We've partnered with the Gabby Petito Foundation, and together we are launching a petition to get signatures from parents and students who agree that we need a nationwide campaign similar to Mothers Against Drunk Driving on the hidden dangers of college, to push college campuses to share more safety tools, safety nets, education, awareness of what's happening. We currently have 9 nonprofits behind us, and all of us share what are these hidden dangers, and this can't be left up to parents to teach and educate their kids, because it's far more than what a parent is knowledgeable on. We have safety experts in the field. We truly have these incredible people who were trained through military, terrorism training, college campus training, and psychologists, and people who are absolute experts, who know how to avoid, how to detect, how to prevent, how to recognize these dangers. And that's who needs to teach our kids. That's who needs to do this campaign and bring it into the schools. We've got the National Crime Prevention Council behind us as well. We've reached out to this young guy who graduated from the University of Miami again, another serendipitous event, and he's created this incredible app, which is really like a body cam, and it records audio and video of situations that you're in where you feel uncomfortable. You get in a ride share, you press the button, and it records. You can invite 10 friends into the group chat. They can listen to the audio and video. Anybody in the group can send a discreet call to 911, sending the video to 911 with your location to come find you. It can also send an Amber Alert to your parents or to anyone you feel needs an Amber Alert. And it uses AI to identify the threat. So even if the student doesn't think they're in trouble, if AI recognizes a threat, it sends you a note to say, listen, it sounds like you're in a dangerous situation. And if you don't respond to it, they're going to send 911. And this app would have saved Bailey's life. It can be given to all the students on campus. My husband went with the owner of this company to do a presentation at the University of Miami. We begged and pleaded for them to replace the blue light system with the app, give the students the safety app. And they said it would send a red flag out to families, and they didn't want to do it. So there's a lot of work to still be done. We truly feel like this could have been prevented. There was not a safety net in place, and there absolutely can be. There are so many students who suffer tragedies, and we can do better. The book supports the foundation and shares the message. I wrote the book because Bailey's story is just so fascinating and so synchronistic. There are so many signs and so many breadcrumbs left before she died, and the messages after she died, that I had to share that with the world. It's not just about the tragedy. It's not just about the laws that failed. It's not just about a true crime story. It's about the afterlife. It's about why are we here and what is our purpose? My faith has been restored, which is crazy because when this happened to me, I cursed God. I was angry. But Bailey continued to shine a light for me from the other side and teach me and show me that there is so much more to our spirit and soul than what we have any possible concept of in our human form. That is my story, and that is the book. I started writing it in September, and I finished the book by January with two little kids in preschool. It was the easiest book to write. The words poured out of me as though Bailey was writing the book for me. The healing part of the book, I think, is when you put the words on paper. It just helps you to process it again and again and to accept the reality of what has happened. It's called Bailey, B-A-Y-L-I-E, which is how Bailey liked to spell her name, on the website baileyswishfoundation.org. And it's also available on Amazon. And although a lot of the proceeds go to Jeff Bezos, there are some proceeds that go to the foundation. So we do appreciate any purchase at all on the book. We actually tried to reopen the case after I wrote the book. We've been on a few big news outlets since the book has been launched, and a lot of people questioning why this wasn't investigated further. We're also part of a victim services group for families who do not receive justice. We had the case transferred out. We got all the files at that point, and the interviews that were done with the two men who committed this crime were never convicted, were never even charged. The interview that is on tape that we have asks things like, why did you go up to your apartment to get the water? Oh, I forgot my ID. And the officer says, but it's 2 o'clock in the morning. How do you not have your ID if you've been at the clubs all night? Oh, I keep it in my phone. Didn't you have your phone to book the ride share? Oh yeah, I have two phones. It's really hard to listen to because you know they're guilty. The best that we would be able to do would be basically to publicly shame them, to bring the attention to what happened, to perhaps even have a trial, but they would never be convicted because we didn't have the evidence in Bailey's system, in her blood. So that would be the best we'd get. What we really want to do is bring this to light. I think these things will happen. These things take time and money and effort. It's just like legislation for Bailey's Law. For us to get the paperwork in at every school included with the admission forms, that should be a no-brainer. Why is that hard to do? Just include the forms. Yet we have to go to legislation, which will cost about $20,000 to take a bill through Congress. So it'll happen. And I'm sure we'll get safety apps into all the schools eventually, but it's not going to happen easily. So when that comes out, we would ask that people sign the petition, go to our website, the baileyswishfoundation.org. Again, purchase the book to support the cause. You can book me as a speaker for speaking engagements. I've done a lot of speaking engagements for corporations, for hospitals, for their staff on this sort of gray zone with the legal forms and the healthcare proxies, but also a lot of talks through the College Safety Campaign to students and schools. So there's all kinds of different aspects that we can get this word out, but really we need action. We need to change things. There's just too much out there. There's so many nonprofits working at sharing different stories, and we all need to come together to one national campaign, which is what we're trying to do. Although I seem very stoic now and I'm able to tell this story, it's taken a long time to get this strength. I could not have done this in the early stages of grief, not even close. Believe me, I was the last person who wanted to hear that I would heal one day. I didn't want anyone to say that in a few years, you'll feel better. No one wants to hear that when you're losing your child. I wanted to be in grief forever. I owed that to Bailey. But what brought me through was understanding that, again, there's just so much more to life than what we can see.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate everything you're doing, and I appreciate that you're continuing Bailey's legacy and work to make the world a better place, as she would have done too.
Thank you so much, Amy, and I appreciate you having me on your podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I knew I had been deceived by the prophet, but not necessarily by Ted. What I learned from Sarah is that they had actually been dating up until we got together. She said that right before we got together, they were sitting on the couch and all of a sudden he attacked her. She ended up going to church leadership and she told them what he had done because she was terrified. They ended up not believing her. Nobody told me to be careful around him. And in fact, they ended up helping throw us our engagement party.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.